Deutsche Welle, Africa Link.
Welcome to Africa Link this Friday, the 23rd of June, 2017. I'm Isaac Mugabe, your host.
And I'm Abubakar Jallo with your responses and some of the stories that are trending on social media.
Coming up on the program, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres calls for international solidarity with Uganda at a fundraising summit to help the country deal with nearly a million South Sudanese fleeing war.
I have seen the Uganda borders open. I have seen the doors of the Uganda people open. I've seen the hearts of the Uganda people open. But not all doors are open in the world.
German Chancellor Angela Merkel has expressed her disappointment that there's been no progress to share the burden of migrants within the EU.
She's been disappointed with what Hungary and Poland and some other Eastern European countries are doing in that respect for quite some time now, ever since the migration crisis started.
And our top social media topic today is the video of controversial Nigerian secessionist Nnamdi Kanu, who is seeking independence for Igbo land in the southeast, known as Biafra. Your response is shortly.
And I'm sure Abu, they're still kicking it right now.
Lots of it.
Okay, right then. But before all that, here's a chance to hear what's been happening around the world.
I'm Jane Nyinge with DW News. The UN Human Rights Council has finally decided to send a group of experts to the Democratic Republic of Congo to investigate killings and other atrocities in the Kasai region. More than 3,300 people have been killed and 1.3 million displaced following 8 months of violence between a militia and government forces. UN Rights Chief Zaid Rad Al Hussein, who is to name the fact-finding experts, had repeatedly called for the inquiry into Kasai attacks, an opposition stronghold.
It is the duty of the Congolese authorities, army and police, to protect the people, to act in accordance with human rights principles, and to bring perpetrators of human rights violations and abuses to justice. Accountability for these shocking incidents must be assured. I regret that to date the Congolese government has not fulfilled these obligations of protection and accountability.
Nigeria acting President Yemi Osinbajo met with regional leaders in an effort to quell ethnic tensions. Since the beginning of the month, there has been growing tension between northern Muslim and southeastern Igbo people after Muslim activists demanded the eviction of Igbo from the north after their calls for a separate southeastern state known as Biafra. British Prime Minister Theresa May has presented her proposal on the rights of 3 million European Union citizens in Britain after it leaves the bloc. May promised those already living in Britain will have permanent rights to healthcare, education and all other benefits after Brexit. German Chancellor Angela Merkel welcomed the move.
Theresa May hat uns heute deutlich gemacht.
British Prime Minister Theresa May made clear today that EU citizens who have been in Great Britain for 5 years can keep their full rights. That's a good start. But of course, there are many, many other questions about Brexit, about finances, about the relationship with Ireland, which means we still have a lot to do until October.
A Kenyan court has ruled presidential election results announced at the constituency level would be final, adding that no further changes will be allowed. Kenya is set to hold its presidential election on the 8th of August. U.S. President Donald Trump has said he's willing to work with Republican senators who are not ready to vote for the Senate's Obamacare repeal and replacement bill. Republican leadership is aiming to have a vote on the bill next week before senators leave Washington for July recess. For more news and information, visit dw.com or download the DW app. My name is Jane Nyinge.
Welcome once again to the program. My name is Isaac Mugabe.
And I am Abubakar Jallo.
We begin today's program in Uganda, where donors attending a UN-backed summit have pledged about $350 million to help Uganda cope with an influx of refugees fleeing conflict in South Sudan. Uganda needs some $2 billion for its surging refugee population. The money would fund operations for the next 12 months. About 1.3 million refugees have fled to Uganda, of whom an estimated 950,000 have come from South Sudan, displaced by the country's escalating civil war. From Kampala, Alex Sita sent this report.
Uganda became the nation.
Uganda is said to be near the breaking point. According to UN reports, already food rations have been cut in half for some refugees. Indio Abdulkadir is a 17-year-old Somali refugee living in Kampala. She admits that the strain on the available resources is very visible.
Many schools do not have adequate classrooms, teachers, learning and teaching materials, and the supplies needed to provide good quality education.
Abdulkadir is one of the 1,271,000 refugees now living in Uganda. Most of them live in settlement camps. Others are involved in local businesses depending on their skills. They have been able to start their own sources of income rather than depending on aid. But many still need assistance. The UN says Uganda needs at least $8 billion to tackle the crisis over the next 4 years. Friday's summit brought pledges of $358 million, far short of the goal. But UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres is not disappointed by the figure.
I have seen the Uganda borders open. I have seen the doors of the Uganda people open. I've seen the hearts of the Uganda people open. But not all doors are open in the world. Not all refugees are accepted. Some are rejected. And sometimes the country is much richer than Uganda. So it's also necessary to look into this example and to say clearly that the international community must come together and reestablish the integrity of the refugee protection regime everywhere in the world.
Ugandan President Yoweri Kaguta Museveni says priority should be health and education.
Education for knowledge and skills, so that having lost property in their home countries, especially for the children and the youth, do not lose time for knowledge and skills acquisition. That's very, very crucial for the children.
Away from the pledges, the delegates want a solution to be put in place to end the displacements. Here is what the European Union Commissioner for Humanitarian Aid, Christos Stylianides, had to say.
The lives of many South Sudanese hang in balance, threatened by brutal violence, famine, and hardship. Peace in South Sudan is out of reach, unfortunately. There can be no military solution.
Speaker after speaker praised Uganda's open policy towards refugees, but they agree the country cannot be left alone to cope with the crisis.
Alex Chita reporting from Kampala.
And now, we have a response here from Katai Kaloy, who is a Ugandan living in the UAE. He says, I think Uganda is a peaceful country where refugees are given free land, free education, and the opportunity to carry out small-scale businesses. I know, Isaac, you spend a lot of time in Uganda.
Yeah, let me hope, you know, he won't want to relocate for free land. They're just giving to refugees. Anyway, Papa Ashon from Ghana, Accra says, right step in the direction for only 4 years. Many more years of brutality or ceasefire afterwards. We hope for freedom and prosperity.
And a response here from Isaac Godwin in Liberia said, I would say Uganda has really been of great help to the refugees of South Sudan. I hope they get this aid and money that they are asking for.
Sharing a plot of land with someone is something, you know, laudable, isn't it?
Yeah,
you know?
That's definitely a huge...
And the fact that, you know, land factor is already something, you know, people fight over in Africa, across Africa, Abu.
Big generosity there.
Well, anyway, German Chancellor Angela Merkel has expressed her disappointment that there's been no progress to share the burden of migrants within the EU. Merkel was speaking at the end of a two-day European Leaders Summit in Brussels. Leaders also discussed security and economic issues. The summit followed a foiled suicide bombing in the Belgian capital Brussels this week and recent attacks in London and Paris. It has also been overshadowed by discussions on Britain's drive to leave the 28-nation bloc. Before we came on air, I spoke to DW's Brussels bureau chief, Max Hoffman, and he started off by telling me why the Chancellor was deeply disappointed.
You know, that disappointment, that's not a new thing. She's been disappointed with what Hungary and Poland and some other Eastern European countries are doing in that respect for quite some time now, ever since the migration crisis started in the European Union. But she said today at the press conference, you know, I'm not going to stop talking about it. This is important. You just have to imagine when you're sitting with the Italian prime minister or the Greek prime minister, what they feel, how they feel, what kind of situation they're in, you know, being the frontline countries where all the migrants land in the first place from Africa, but also from Syria. and then try to empathize with what they feel. That's how you find a compromise, and not another way. So she said, I would wish that these countries, Hungary, Poland, do the same thing. And it's clear that the French president, Emmanuel Macron, agrees with her on that. So both completely support what the EU Commission is doing at the moment, opening up infringement procedures against countries like Poland and Hungary because of their lack of solidarity in the migration crisis.
Is that enough pressure for these countries you've mentioned, Poland and Hungary, to take in more refugees and ease off the burden on countries like Greece and Italy?
Well, in the end, it's always a question of money in the European Union, or most of the time it is. And countries like Poland and Hungary get a lot of money out of Brussels, cohesion funds, for example. And if this infringement procedure leads to a hefty fine, financial fine, that is stuff that hurts them. But for them, it's also important that they rally a part, at least, of the voters back home, because they are so opposed to the whole comprehensive migration strategy from Brussels and from the German chancellor. So for them, it's really the question of, do they profit more from having this strategy, or do they profit more from getting the money? But you can expect once it's about the money, once they get less money, once they get the financial fines, that there might be movement in this.
DW's Max Hoffman in Brussels. Now, Botswana's former president, Ketumire Masire, is dead. He passed away on Thursday at a hospital in the capital, Gaborone. For those who don't remember him, Masire was Botswana's second president after independence and was in office from 1980 to 1998. But who exactly was Masire? Zipporah Nyambura has prepared this fact box.
Born on July 23rd in Kanye, Botswana, Sir Ketumile Masire was a leading figure in the independence movement. He is largely credited for introducing the two-term limits and automatic succession by the deputy in case the president retires. He took over presidency in 1980 following the death of President Seretse Khama, and from there anchored Botswana's stability and a period of economic growth in a country that has enjoyed peaceful transitions since independence in 1966. The former president will also be remembered as Africa's peace broker. He was largely involved in efforts to end violence between Mozambique's government and the main opposition, Renamo Party, in his role as co-chair of an international group of mediators. Masire also led the international panel of eminent personalities in investigating the causes which triggered the Rwandan genocide in 1994. Apart from mediating Mozambique's political crisis, Masire was also instrumental in brokering peace deals in Kenya and Lesotho. Though gone, his legacy as Africa's most respected elder statesman will definitely live on.
Zipporah Nyambura, and with that fact box. Now over to you, Abu, with comments from the Biafra video.
The Biafra video is attracting a lot of comment. We have Mortgage Joseph Eluzai, who says, Nigeria, like many other African countries, has failed to build a modern nation that is exclusive and representative of its diversity. This is simply because the colonial masters handed power to a self-conceited, short-sighted elite that is using the same divide and rule to stay in power.
And Razak Mumuni says, I'm not a Nigerian, but it is clear that Nigeria shouldn't have been a single country. The differences among them are too huge.
Chijioke Ozuenu said they need referendum to know if the Biafrans really want to stay or leave. And another one from Aminu Kumasi says, in the city of blind men, one man is a king, referring there to Nnamdi Kanu.
Yeah, and of course, the video has got so many clicks. Abu, at the moment, I can see 14,000 people have watched this video. And many comments are coming in, you know, tens of them. And all of them are arguing the same thing, I think, you know, the way the politicians, you know, handled the situation. Now, one of them is Moga, says, Nigeria, like many other African countries, has failed to build a modern nation that, you know, can be united.
Indeed. And let me give you a final response. I'm afraid we're running out of time. We have Carlo Ngambi, who said he's a fraud with no clear agenda.
Keep them flowing, and we will read them whenever we can right here on Africa Link. And just in case you've just tuned in, you're listening to DW's Africa Link program. Live from our studios here in Bonn, Germany, I'm Isaac Mugabe.
And I'm your co-host, Abu Bakar Jalo.
Coming up in the next 15 minutes, a South African blogger tells Africa Link about his work.
I think at the moment you'd be hard-pressed to find anyone who's pro-government because everyone's upset with them, even members of the party, the ANC party themselves.
And former US President Barack Obama speaks about the relationship between the United States and Africa during his tenure. We'll be hearing how Donald Trump is unbothered by such relations.
And we are still keeping a close eye onto our top social media topic, which is the video of the controversial Nigerian secessionist Nnamdi Kanu, who is seeking independence for Biafra State.
That's very correct, Abu. To America first, where not long ago, this man heralded a new era in US relations with the continent of Africa.
And as president, I've worked to transform America's relationship with Africa so that we're truly listening to our African friends and working together as equal partners. And I'm proud of the progress that we've made.
Those were the days when former US President Barack Obama emphasized the importance of Africa for America's foreign policy. Obama visited Africa four times during his time in office, partly motivated by his own African heritage and family ties to Kenya. It is a stark contrast to the current president, Donald Trump, who so far hasn't even mentioned Africa much in his first half year in office, except in the context of a budget proposal that demands deep cuts to the US development aid budget and restrictions on the use of American money to fund planned parenthood projects in Africa. So what is the attitude of the new US administration towards Africa? Our Washington correspondent, Karsten von Name, takes a closer look.
Shortly after he came into office, US President Donald Trump made a few phone calls to African leaders, including the presidents of Nigeria, South Africa, and Kenya. But since then, it seems that Africa is basically off the agenda in Washington, as the White House is preoccupied with domestic scandals, Russia, the Middle East, and North Korea. One problem is that Trump still hasn't filled a number of posts dealing with Africa at the State Department, says Bronwyn Bruton of the Atlantic Council, a Washington-based think tank.
Africa policy is not made at senior levels. It's made at the assistant secretary level. And if you don't have an assistant secretary in place, you basically don't have anybody doing Africa policy.
Many among the U.S. foreign policy establishment fear that disengagement could lead to a power vacuum in Africa, a vacuum countries like China, India, or Brazil are eager to fill. That sentiment was echoed by participants at last week's U.S.-African Business Summit in Washington, such as Ayodele Kusamoto, a lawyer from Nigeria.
There is a contest for resources from Africa, and clearly Asia, China, it's way ahead and doing a lot more for Africa and a lot more in Africa.
Americans have to change their attitudes, agrees Abdou Souleya Diop, a representative for Morocco's business community.
We need really US to reconsider the way they are dealing with Africa. We don't need aid and some subsidies. We need really great cooperation in transfer of know-how, in business development, joint ventures. We have not the same strength than US, but we can be real partners for business tomorrow.
In fact, trade could be one of the areas where the new U.S. government will not only continue policies of the Obama administration, but actually start some new initiatives, according to Brian Newbert of the U.S. State Department.
There are tremendous trade opportunities with many African markets. As Africa invests in its infrastructure, there are opportunities for many American companies with technology and products and services. And then, of course, many African countries produce products for the U.S. market.
And then there's the U.S. military. Even under Obama, the Americans extended their network of bases in Africa to gather intelligence and carry out drone strikes against terrorist groups. And Trump is going even further, giving the military basically a free hand, says Katie Zimmerman of the conservative think tank American Enterprise Institute.
We've already seen some changes coming through. The most significant to date has been the one with regards to Somalia, which came through in March 2017, where U.S. forces now have the ability to conduct offensive attacks against al-Shabaab in protection of our partners on the ground.
Military action, economic development, and good governance, however, have to go hand in hand to improve security, says Katie Zimmerman, echoing the views of many old Africa hands of the Obama administration. In that sense, it might be a good thing that Donald Trump has not put his mark on America's Africa policy yet. That way, some continuity is preserved, at least for the time being.
DW's senior correspondent in Washington, Karsten von Name.
Blog report.
And for our blog report this week, we feature Garrett Cliff, a renowned radio and TV personality in South Africa who also runs his blog, GarrettCliff.com. He came under heavy criticism recently after he was accused of putting out a racist tweet. But that's all behind him now after he sued and won a court case to be reinstated as a judge on the television show Idols of South Africa on Mnet. Now, Cliff does not shy away from calling a spade and the issues on the issues in South Africa, his native country. I spoke to him when he visited our offices here in Bonn and he started by telling me, talking about the new wave of change sweeping across South Africa and how social media is playing a crucial role in articulating these issues. Take a listen.
Well, South Africa is a very interesting place because, again, we have a huge amount of diversity and we have a very young and vibrant democracy. There are challenges in that. There are always people vying for power. There are always people trying to hold on to power. It's an exciting time to be around in South Africa. There are lots and lots of people who have lots of opinions. And the internet provides us with a place to have all those discussions. And we can have them freely and mostly in a constructive manner.
And where does your platform find itself within the spectrum? Like, is it more like pro-government?
We're not ideological. So we have certain shows that are very much left-leaning and very much right-leaning shows. I think at the moment you'd be hard-pressed to find anyone who's pro-government because everyone's upset with them, even members of the party, the ANC party themselves. So we try not to be ideological. I certainly don't, with respect to the other shows, direct their editorial.
Yeah. So have you find yourself being targeted by government officials because of some of the reports that you put out there?
Not necessarily by government officials, but there was an incident last year, and in fact a number of incidents which occurred, where we discovered post those incidents that there was a paid Twitter campaign. A very nefarious international PR company was hired by people who are interested in state capture, and they began a very cynical campaign against free speech and against society, and they did their best to try and polarize people into old categories of race and class and language and ethnicity. And to some degree it worked because it distracted people enough and we started believing our problems were much bigger than they were because the PR around them that was generated. And you know, South Africa has a proud history of overcoming these problems and of trying to build a nation together. And I think largely we've achieved that. We've got 22 years of quite solid history behind us, of cooperation, of meaningful engagement between the races. And this campaign was nothing short of evil.
Quite recently, you were accused of putting out a tweet that was...
It's part of what I was talking to you about a second ago. And there were a number of people who were, in fact. Ultimately, everyone was unsafe because everybody was scared to say what they thought.
So you're basically saying that particular accusation is not actually valid. It's just based on...
Oh, completely invalid. I've got 20 years of a track record to show in media that will prove the opposite, but it was perhaps ill-timed, and there was this campaign, a paid Twitter campaign, to divert people's attention and to create controversy where there wasn't any. I tweeted, "People don't understand freedom of speech," and they inferred, by they I mean the broad public and particularly these people who were looking for something to latch onto, they inferred that what I meant was that racist speech ought to be protected, which is absolutely not what I believe. I mean, in South Africa's constitution, it's very clear that hate speech of any kind is to be fought and is to be negated where possible.
That was South Africa talk show host and TV personality Garrett Cliff.
Thanks indeed, Abu, for that. And it's that time of the week when we turn the page and feature sports. Joining us now is DW Sports editor Chuck Penfold. And as expected, he'll start off by telling us about the Confederation Cup and results from last evening's matches.
Well, let's start with Cameroon. The Africa Cup of Nations champions haven't been having an easy time of it. They lost their first match, of course, 2-0 to Chile. Then they only managed a 1-1 draw against Australia last night. Zambo Nguissa put the ball past the Australian keeper to give Cameroon a 1-1 lead in injury time of the first half, so things were looking not too bad. But then they threw it all away when there was a foul in the area, resulting in a penalty, which was reviewed on video, and Mark Milligan scored for the Australians, just after the hour mark. So that leaves Cameroon with just 1 point from the first two Group B games, so they're pretty much out of it. As for Germany, well, Joachim Löw was going for his 100th victory since taking over as national team head coach in 2006, but they got off to a terrible start. Mm-hmm. German defender Skodran Mustafi gave the ball away to his Arsenal teammate, Alexis Sanchez, who finished very nicely past Marc-Andre ter Stegen at the near post. That was his 38th goal for Chile, by the way, which makes him that country's top scorer. Now, as the first half last night was drawing to a close, I couldn't see Germany getting an equalizer, at least before the break. I was sort of wondering what Löw was going to say during the halftime break. But then in the 41st minute, Jonas Hector fired a low cross through the box, and Gladbach's Lars Stindl got onto it for the tying goal. And that was the last of the contest. It was also a 1-1 draw. So Germany have a win and a draw from their first two games. They're second in the group behind Chile. First two, of course, go through. So as for who wins that group is going to come down to Sunday when Germany face Cameroon.
Before we talk about the lessons learned from that match, I mean, who's your pick for the man of the match between Germany and Chile, and why?
Yeah, I guess it would have had to be Alexis Sanchez. Okay, he became the country's top goal scorer, but he was causing a lot of trouble for the defenders, especially in the first half. For Germany, maybe also the goal scorer, Lars Stindl, who is a newcomer to the national team at quite a ripe old age, but if he's certainly doing his case for being taken to Russia next year, no harm in these first two games he's played.
Okay, now what lessons could be learned for Joachim Löw after the draw that denied him the 100th win, as coach has mentioned before?
That's hard to say. I think one of the things he's going to be looking at is the defense doesn't seem to be as solid as you'd like it to be. Mm-hmm. I think the other thing that he probably already knew is he's just not taken his first team. He's got a team that's quite young, quite inexperienced, and are also inexperienced at playing together.
And do you think Germany's senior players that were left out of the squad, were presumably to enjoy their summer, are following closely what the younger players are up to at the Confederation Tournament? Or some maybe could be worried that, you know, some of these kids could take up their slots?
I see no evidence of that. I knew you were going to ask me that, so I poked around on social media to see what I could find. It looks to me, just based on that they're watching it very casually at best. I saw Jerome Boateng tweeted out to Arturo Vidal before that game saying, you know, I'm going to be going for my boys tonight, even though we're teammates at Bayern. But I think they're probably watching it casually, but enjoying the summer that they deserve off.
I was speaking to Chuck Penfold about sports. Now, back to you, ABJ, as I prefer to call you, Abakal Jallo, because you don't know what ABJ stands for.
Thanks for summarizing it.
Abakal Jallo.
I will take you to that controversial video of the Nigerian secessionist Nnamdi Kanu. A response here from Rikweke Fats from Nigeria. He said, Nnamdi Kanu is just an opportunistic fellow feeding on the political naivety of his region. As soon as he gets what he wants, he will run back to London, his base, or better still, he will still seize the opportunity to contest for elections into an office, and there goes away the IPOB dream. That's the independent of Biafra.
But well, in the video here, he clearly says that he's not interested in any political position, and Abu, you edited that video, isn't it? I don't think so controversial. Anyway, Isaac Godwin from Liberia says, Nnamdi Kanu needs to be rearrested. He has gone against his bail terms and conditioned by hosting stay-home protests, encouraging gathering of more than 10 persons, etc. Nigeria has a lot of problems to worry about for now, rather than paying attention to separation.
And before I continue with the next one, just a reminder that these are not our comments. These are comments from people who are responding to the video on Facebook, DW Africa. One final response here from Chukunonso Odidika. He says, we Biafrans have completed the experiment of one Nigeria. We need referendum just like the British people did regarding the EU.
Thank you indeed, Abu. On behalf of the production crew with us in the studios here, Zipporah Nyambura, Guljabin Abasi and Andrea Yost, I'm Isaac Mugabe.
And I'm Abubakar Jallo.
Wishing you a splendid weekend ahead. Till Monday, see you again.